We're going to call the House Committee on Public Employee Retirement System to order. And we're going to hear in work session, if possible, House Bill 2343 today. It's a bill that Representative Jensen brought forward. So when he comes, we're going to move directly to that. But in the meantime, I want to have public hearing and invited testimony on the two successor plans. And we invited Union Coalition and the Employer Coalition to send somebody forward to talk about some parameters on those and what they see coming up in the future for successor plans. And so I'm going to open public hearings on House Bill 2008 and House Bill 2020. And I believe Jim Green was going to come forward on the for the Employer Coalition. So Jim, why don't you come on up and share your thoughts with us. And when Representative Jensen comes, we'll recess the hearings on these and open a hearing on his.
Give me the sign, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm here today representing a PERS-covered employer, Coalition of PERS-covered Employers that includes the Special Districts Association, the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, and the Oregon School Boards. Roughly 750 PERS-covered employers. Obviously, we do have a considerable interest in what may be a successor system to the current system that we have. As you know, the group introduced, or is having introduced, House Bill 2003. A presentation was made earlier this week for changes to the current system. We believe those changes need to be made. And what we've done thus far as a coalition is talk about broad parameters for a successor system. We're still developing ideas, but we have talked about parameters and what we see currently that the four organizations and the PERS-covered employers could support. A couple of things. First, with regard to a successor system, there were goal statements that we thought needed to be necessary within a successor system plan. And these include the affordability for employers and predictable costs for employers and taxpayers, predictable benefits for our employees and retired members, a simple system. It's easy to understand to everybody that has to take a look at it, because I believe if you take a look at our statutory scheme for the current one, I would think the word convoluted may be a little bit too slight of a word to take a look at our current system. It's a very complex system. We would like to see, if a new system is created, a very simple, transparent system so that everyone can understand exactly what's enrolled into the plan. We also believe that the shared costs and market risks should be shared between both the members and the employers. Portability for members is a big one that we have all said needs to be built into any sort of a successor system if it's going to be put forward. And there needs to be the alignment of interest between the members and the employers when you have a fiduciary sitting as a board. And we believe right now that the issue comes down to, you know, in the Lipscomb decision with regard to fiduciary, who do they owe the fiduciary duty to? It's been said many times they don't owe a duty to the employers or the taxpayers. That may be true. It may not be true. We do believe that if employers are funding the system, there is some duty owed to them, however, and that's to keep some of the costs under control, make them predictable, and make it affordable as well. We also believe that any new system should be separate from the current system and should include new hires. Not a complete shutdown of the existing system as it stands right now. We're looking into the legality of those issues, because if you shut down the system, put a close on it, and force Tier 1 and Tier 2 members into a new system, there could be legal challenges to that. We're investigating, having our attorneys take a look at those issues for us. One of the things is we've been in court a lot over PERS, and we've had pieces of legislation come out of this body in previous sessions, House Bill 3349 in particular, that cost local governments a significant piece of money because we taxed benefits for state employees, and we are very leery of litigation that would cause additional costs to employers and to the taxpayers of Oregon. So right now what we would support is a plan that would only be for new hires at a date certain in the future. We also believe it should be for state and local governments, including schools. And as to the issue of legislators and judges, we've been asked that question. We really do not have opinion on that, Mr. Chairman. That's up for discussion between and amongst you and judges in the system. But we do believe that it should be a single system like we currently have, as opposed to bifurcated system like many other states have, where they have CalPERS for teachers and CalPERS for local and local governments. We believe it should be one system. Should retain the ability for local entities to create a separate system for their own police and firefighter. We have several municipalities and other entities around the state that create those. They would like to have the ability to maintain those as well. We should have different classes also in this system. We do understand and recognize the dangers that police and firefighters put themselves in, and that that does create some urge for a different system. Also general service, and we also like the idea of the pools that are currently established. While we have never, all of us have never supported mandatory pooling, we don't like to be told what to do. We do believe that schools operate in a little bit different fashion than, say, the cities and counties, so there is some need to recognize that difference. We also, as you note in House Bill 2003 and in many of the discussions we had before your task force,
You can finish your sentence. Bob will wait for that.
We believe that there should not be a money match retirement benefit option for the calculation of the annuity that would be due that member. Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll come back.
I'm going to recess the hearings on House Bill 2008, House Bill 2020. We do have some students in the audience from Sisters High School, and I had mentioned to them earlier that we may be taking up House Bill 2004. However, we just received the amendments back just before committee, and the chair hasn't even looked at them yet. So I'm not going to make them available until after I look at them to see if they halfway do what we'd like them to do. So they'll be available Friday or Monday after I've had a chance to take a look at them. And I'm sure you could request them of folks, and you'll probably end up getting a copy of them, but I don't know that they'll be the final amendment. But so we'll take a look at that. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2343 and call Representative Jensen. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my apologies for being late. And
it's quite all right. I know you had other business to attend to.
The Judiciary Chair didn't want to stick to this time schedule today, so and I got engrossed in the material that was being presented and lost track of the time. Again, my apologies. House Bill 2343 is my second attempt to clarify or rectify a problem that appeared in my district, and I believe Judge Smallman is here to testify to the bill, and he will be able maybe to tell you a little more of the you know, his personal specifics with it. But specifically, for reasons known only to some higher being, I think, the way back when judges were not in the same pool as far as PERS is concerned, they had their own retirement system set up, and PERS system set up, and subsequently that changed. At any rate, Judge Smallman wound up having a tenure on the court, and when his tenure expired, I believe consequence of an election, the money that he had put into the PERS retirement fund was not obtainable. Now, the interesting thing with this was that it was not only could he not get the money out, but he additionally couldn't even, you know, I guess get it out at retirement, and the only way that it would ever come out was in his estate. Well, perhaps that wouldn't have been so bad, that we could make a case that it would have been worthwhile for him to leave a little larger estate, and that would have provided for that. But the problem was that, and is, that the amount of money that he contributed has been there for many years now, and unlike all of the other things you're hearing about how much PERS accounts have grown, Judge Smallman's account grew zero. That is, there was never any interest or other type of earnings attributed to that. So the original contribution of $1,000, which was many years ago, is still worth $1,000. But I think if you, with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, it would be easier if Judge Smallman would give you his perspective on it, and then I would answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Chair, I was appointed district court judge in July 1st of 1980, and from there until the end of the year, sums were held out of my paycheck to go into the judge's retirement program. When I lost the election in November and left office in December, I called up PERS and asked them if they would please send me back the money, and they informed me no, I could get it when I retired. So I waited till 2001, I believe, to retire, and I called them up and asked them about it, and they said, well, we're sure sorry about that, but when you die, your widow can have it. And so then I called my friend Representative Jensen. He said, well, maybe we can fix that. So he went to PERS and asked him to draft some kind of a legislation that would take care of it, which they did. And it came before a different House committee and passed the House, passed the Senate, was signed by the governor. And about 4 or 5 months went by, and I called up PERS and I said, now that this bill is passed, can I have my $1,000? And they said, well, we're looking into it. And so about another 6 months went by, and no word, and I called them up again, and they said, well, you can talk to so-and-so. So I talked to so-and-so, and she says, I think maybe you better talk to my boss. And so they referred me to the boss, and the boss said, well, we're going to write you a letter. And the letter came in due course about 8 months after this body was dissolved, saying that, well, we took another look at it, and you can get the $1,000 when you die, or it'll go into your estate, but we're not going to get it now, because I believe it had something to do as being a member judge, and I did not qualify as a member judge. The problem that through the years, the federal government, of course, saw the light long about 15 years ago and said private employers can't keep employees' money that they put into the retirement funds when they quit. If they don't qualify for matching funds and qualify for retirement, the companies have to give the money back. But it didn't apply to the state of Oregon, obviously, and this bill would then get the state PERS program in line with the federal statutes. And I see that the representative said they have to give me back the money along with the earnings thereon. So I hopefully, in the last 23 years, it's increased in value a little bit, perhaps. And I'd appreciate it if you gentlemen would recommend to the body that they pass this legislation.
If I could continue just, Mr. Chair, a moment on that. I think there was they were in touch with the Attorney General, and I got Attorney General's opinion that the original bill that we worked with legislative council. Legislative council worked with the PERS people, but that the original bill we had, which was House Bill 3366 in a previous session, didn't do what we thought it was going to do. So subsequently, we have, I ask legislative council to work with PERS and the Attorney General's office to make sure we got a bill drafted that would do what was intended. And to my knowledge, that is what you have in front of you today, that all parties agree that this will solve this particular problem. I think there are, you know, maybe a half a dozen other people scattered around the state that may fall under the same category that we have here.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Pearson.
Mr. Chair, will there be other witnesses who can describe the source of payment, whether their earnings and the impacts?
I would expect PERS might be able to do that.
I'll hold my questions till then.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Steve Delaney, did you want to come up and talk about our issue here?
For the record, Steve Delaney, PERS Legislative Liaison. First, I'm happy to report that PERS also concurs that House Bill 2343 will allow Judge Smallman to get his money out. Just a brief history of what actually occurred to lead to this issue. The Judge's Retirement Fund was separate from PERS up until 83. In 83, a PERS Judge Member Plan was put into place. But the Judge Retirement Fund continued in place for some time. Judges were given their option, remaining with the old planners, coming to PERS. In 91, the legislature saw that there was a surplus in the Judge's Retirement Fund, $20 million. $800,000 of that was a surplus. And so a bill was introduced to roll that old Judge's Retirement Fund into the PERS Judge Member Fund to capture that surplus and alleviate costs to the state. Well, in that rush to get that through, what was overlooked were that there were 14 dormant accounts, of which Judge Smallman's was one of them. And there were no real provisions made into legislation in 91 when those dollars moved over to really direct PERS as to what was to happen to those 14 dormant accounts. Out of that $20 million, those 14 accounts represented $122,000 approximately. From that point on, PERS has been caretaker of the dollars, has not distributed interest earnings to these dollars. Our reasoning, and I had to check with our people that ran the judge's program to find out the history on this, was that there were no specific directions in the statute at the time of the movement of the Judge's Retirement Fund over to PERS as to distribute earnings, and we will normally only distribute earnings when told specifically by the legislature to do so. What happened last session, there was an attempt to make a change to judge members being able to get their money out of the fund. Unfortunately, at the time, we didn't understand that this was specifically Judge Smallman and the Judge's Retirement Fund. We were aware that there was a problem with PERS judge members. There was some very strict language there with regard to withdrawals for PERS judge members that did not apply to general service members. So House Bill 3366, I believe it is, 3366 took care of that issue for judge members, but really did do nothing for the dormant, those 14 dormant individuals in the judge's retirement fund. This bill does take care of those 14 members and allows the withdrawal of those funds. What does remain still as a question to this committee is what we anticipate doing, and we just need to have it on the record as far as what this committee's intention is. With regard to the phraseology that was mentioned here today in the bill, line 19 on page 2, it does state that the individual may withdraw the amounts deducted from the person's salary with all earnings on those deductions. And our question would be, or our anticipation would be, to pay out the deductions that we received together with the earnings we received up to 91, but we would not be, under our normal process, paying out earnings from 91 to the present time unless this body indicates that was the policy they had in mind with regard to this piece of legislation.
If I might add, Chair Knope, members of the committee, this is a perfect example of two things. One is how powerful the words in the statute can be when they're there or when they're not, and that we do actually try to execute the statute as it's written, even when there are gaps. The second thing is, Chair Knope, you may recall during the task force that you ran in the interim that we talked about that we have many different sets, subcategories of members, each with their own rule sets in our very complex system. This, again, is an example of that. We call them flavors of members. And also, you know, if you ask me as a financial person, does it make any sense to husband somebody's money and not award earnings? The answer is no, that's not normal financial practice. However, we're a statutory creature, and we follow the statute. And the statute, and its 44 provisions that in a very detailed fashion tell us how to allocate earnings, and you've seen some of the flow charts during your task force hearings, nowhere is there mentioned this little pool of money. And so this little pool of money has not benefited from any earnings in the fund because the statute didn't tell us to send any money there, but it very explicitly told us where to send the money. I'm not saying that that's good financial practice, but it does seem to comport with the words of the statute. But the issue that Steve brought up does require some guidance to us. If we were to follow the statute as it's written today and what we've done, we would not award retroactive earnings to this small sum of money. If it is the preference of the legislature to do so, we need some direction about where the money needs to come from, because all of the money from 1991 on has been allocated to other accounts.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to get a feel for the numbers of other flavors of accounts that there might be out there. Not the 14 from these retired judges' accounts, but other types of accounts that are inactive in these other flavors that we probably need to reach in and address. Not that we're anxious to go and put some earnings to those accounts, because those earnings from 1991 forward have been allocated and distributed in accordance with law. And I don't know that I'm anxious to see if we can find out if there aren't somebody out there that needs to be allocated more money when the law didn't provide for them to be allocated more money. But I am anxious to find out if there are other flavors of these kinds of accounts that, as a result of the various modifications and changes and nuances in the plan, have through the years been allowed to stand dormant and idle without additional earnings, because it looks like that would comprise a separate class that we need to go in and address particularly as we clean up the IT portion of your budgets as well. Rather than trying to account for these multiple flavors, we ought to just go ahead and figure out a way to clean the code up and distribute those and dispose of them.
We are aware of one large category of member accounts that do not have earnings awarded to them, and I believe it is by statute, and that is inactive accounts after their fifth year of inactivity. We cease to award earnings to those accounts. Again, it's not something that would be normally happen in the course of the financial world, but it is in accordance with the statute.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have an idea, Jim, how many accounts there are of that nature that probably, I mean, a financially prudent person looking at that account balance year after year, and if it was $2,300 in 1987 and it's $2,300 in 1997, they got to be looking at that and saying, I wonder when I'm going to get some earnings off of this, when they never will get any earnings. Do we have any idea how many accounts might have the tens of thousands of accounts out there that might be affected with this?
Chair Knope, Representative Butler, it is a substantial number of accounts, although not a substantial sum of money in contrast to the trust fund as a whole. I don't have the figures at my fingertips, but I can provide them to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just by way of, we're in the process on the other end of the budget, in the process of examining, and from the JLCIMT, we're also in the process of examining the information technology issues that are related to the new platform that PERS is anxious to convert to. And these are the kinds of issues that we really need to scrub out and get addressed early on so that we can win all these things out. And as I say, in all fairness to a group of Oregonians or former Oregonians or estates thereof, and I recognize that there are some accounts that are just absolutely dead letter accounts that people we don't have addresses on. But I would say, in all fairness to these folks, the account balances are small, and we're not doing anyone any good, especially them, but also not the plan to go ahead and continue to maintain these as separate accounts that don't go anywhere. They're just, it's a bumper car that's stuck in a corner, it looks like to me.
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, we do periodically try to find these people when they have not made themselves known to us and ask for their money. But it's an expensive process to try to track down people, and we have to balance that against the other administrative costs of the fund. So it results in something like $25 or $30 million being bumper carred in the corner, if you will.
Mr. Chair, didn't we submit an LC that we're going to prepare relative to the State Estate Fund? Steve's shaking his head yes. So I thought we had talked about the possibility of those dead letter accounts going. Perhaps Mr. Delaney would like to respond on
that. Sure, Representative Butler. I don't recall specifically the language as to whether it was directing it to Estate as much as there was specific language that came through the chair's committee, the interim committee, that was saying that a fee should be charged in trying to locate these accounts when they have not been located, so that there isn't an expense to the fund in trying to locate these people and give them their dollars.
Did we get that done, Mr. Chair? I don't recall.
Well, we got the fee bill. We got the fee bill in, but I don't think it has the language that you're talking about.
Well, we just fee them until they're all gone, Mr. Chair. That's. I mean, you look for them until there's nothing in the account to give them. So.
In my service on other committees, it seems like that when a state agency has property of someone else, that they normally move it off to. What is it, the Division of State Lands and into the Common School Fund. Does that happen in this case, or do you guys just hold on to it forever?
Chair Canope, it does not happen in this case, and the reason is that because other agencies are not operating with monies that are in a trust. And so there are substantial fiduciary complications, and it's a slippery slope to start moving dollars out of a trust in which you are a fiduciary, even if the person has not made themselves known, particularly if you have not given them any notice that if they don't take an action, such an action will take place with regard to the monies they have in the trust. So it's a qualitatively different issue when monies move from a trust fund to state lands as opposed to an agency budget to state lands.
Well, in this particular case, though, wouldn't that improve their position if they were ever found? Because you're not crediting interest after 5 years, and I believe they would get interest if it was in the common school fund, and if they were found and came and asked for their money.
No, no.
Mr. Chair.
They don't get any interest in the state common school fund.
They just get
They wouldn't be being charged the fee and the overhead cost either that we're talking about in our fee bill that we had approved in the interim. So I think that it would be appropriate that discussion needs to be held at some point because there would be more resource available for the aggrieved party at some point in the future. But it is a trust fund, and that is a slippery slope, and we need to be very cautious about that.
Okay. Representative Pearson, Nolan, and then Barker.
I understand that the accounts have been dormant in the sense that nothing's been credited to them, but have the assets been dormant? That is, have they been held uninvested over that time? And if they've been uninvested, what has happened to the earnings on those monies?
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, I am virtually positive that the assets have not been dormant. They have been invested, as have all dollars in the funds, by the Oregon Investment Council. I know of no instance in the monies that we at the council oversee that are not invested in order to produce a rate of return. That implies, and I believe it is true, that the earnings on this small number of dollars or the larger number of dollars for inactive members then gets allocated out through the 44 provisions in the statute that direct us how to allocate earnings, and so they essentially go to other members' accounts, to the benefits and force reserve to pay benefits, and to the employer accounts for matching purposes. That I'm looking to my colleague to make sure the director has not strayed.
That is correct. Chair Knope, Representative Pearson, I did ask our staff to run a quick number as to what this $122,000 would have earned to date, and would it be approximately $390,000 in earnings would have accrued over this period.
That's using the regular fund return?
The actual regular fund return, correct.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up. So to paraphrase that then, what's happened is that over time, the other funds within the PERS system, including member accounts, have been credited with $300,000+ over the years that was really earned by these dollars. And so that if we were to provide earnings, is there a mechanism for taking these dollars here out of current earnings so that it would not, so that in effect members in the past got credited a little too much, but now members currently would be credited a little too little? Is that a possibility?
Chair Knope, Representative McPherson, it certainly is a possibility, and if it's the desire of the legislature, obviously you could put it into law. It does raise the issue, and you heard it also in the employer's presentation before, about transferring money from one generation to make up for benefits that were cross-subsidized in another generation of members. Whether that's of concern to you or deciding, that's really your decision, but it's taking from a different set of people to correct what you might believe would be a past error. But it may be the right thing to do. This is a policy issue, not a financial one.
All right. Mr. Chair, if I could. As drafted, the bill before us refers to a payment of that includes all earnings on those deductions. If you were acting under this statutory language, then what would you do to provide the $300,000+ of earnings?
Well, one interpretation is that all earnings on these accounts is zero, because that's what's provided by the existing statute.
Or an interpretation is that the dollars that came to PERS in 1991 were a combination of deductions and earnings.
Pre-1991,
we have been caretaking those deductions and earnings. We'd now be returning those deductions and earnings. The question is, does this also mean an accrual of additional earnings from 91 forward?
And this is why we're seeking clarification. Are you actually asking us to provide the $300,000+ worth of earnings that would have accrued to this account since 1991, or this set of accounts? And if so, is that your explicit desire, and how do we get the money? Which you've made one suggestion already, Representative.
Mm-hmm. Another question, if I could. What would have happened to these dollars under the terms of the judge's retirement plan under which they were originally taken out of pay? Would they have had earnings credited to them before they were paid out?
Help, Steve.
The accounts were drawing earnings while in the judge's retirement fund. What occurred was, again, when the rollover came in 1991, active judge retirement fund members became active PERS judge members and had a active PERS judge member account set up. Those funds were transferred, and they began to accrue interest under our normal PERS interest crediting issues, such as Jim was indicating, the 44 different methodologies used in distributing earnings. There was no direction with regard to the dormant accounts. Again, my understanding from those that were there at the time is that no one really had realized there were dormant accounts when this sum of money was rolling over, and so there was no provision directing PERS as to what to do.
Further, if I could. So the monies that came over in 91, which is the $120,000, is, I think if I'm following you right, is... those are the dollars that were in the 14 accounts that didn't roll over into regular PERS accounts. So that, and that was already a combination of principal and earnings, and that the 300 and some odd thousand is the increment from 91 forward that would have been earned if credited with the general earnings experience of the fund. Is that a fair summary?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, actually what occurred was there was $20 million in judge's retirement fund, which the bulk of that belonged to active judge members. And when they rolled into PERS, they had active PERS member accounts set up for them. Of that $20 million, $122,000 was represented by those 14 dormant accounts represented $122,000 of that. And that simply got parked with a notation in our records, but there was no active PERS account set up for these inactive dormant members. So, yes, as far as the rest of your statement, however, there would have been, had active accounts been set up, then an additional $390,000 would have accrued to present date to that $122,000.
Right. Okay. I think I track all that. And I'd keep it in past the gavel here for the moment. So that, although I think that we have another vice
go
chair
ahead,
here.
Go ahead.
And but there was an order of which questions were going to be taken. I think Representative Nolan was next.
I actually didn't have so much a question as a suggestion that, not with respect to these particular accounts, but to other dormant accounts, that the Division of State Lands treatment is, in fact, apt, and we probably ought to examine using that, maybe even handing them over to the Division of State Lands, because while they're in a trust fund, the Division of State Lands handles many other assets that come to it from private trust funds and trust funds outside the state government. So there's some procedure already in place for them to handle that, and it would relieve you an administrative burden.
You done?
I am, sir.
Sorry, I had to leave the room, and I'm sorry I didn't give the gavel to my other vice chair.
I'm deeply offended.
I knew you would be. Representative Barker.
I assume the reason you don't just hand the money back is because you think somebody might come back to work or seasonal or something, or would there be a reason for non-vested members not to just, when they terminate and they get their final check, give them this one too, and then it's out of your, you don't have to mess with it. Would that be better? Would that be better for future plans to, or future employees from now on if they terminate upon termination and just get their PERS refund if they're not vested?
Representative Knope and Representative Barker, again, that's a policy choice for the legislature to direct this. The reason we didn't hand it out to these individuals is there was no provision in the statute when the judge's retirement fund came over for such a withdrawal.
But Representative Barker, if your question is should we have refund this money to members broadly, putting aside the issue of these 14 specific members, we do that. Do we not?
If located, correct.
Right. So if somebody shows up and asks for it, we do. These 14 accounts represent a special problem because there's a gap in the statute that hasn't given us any instructions as to what to do.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I understand that. What I was thinking of is from, I don't care, June 1st on or July 1st on, anybody who terminates employment who's not vested, you just give them back their money on the spot. I mean, I know it's candid on the spot, but that in that termination process, you just refund that money so it's out of you, so you're not messing with it. Don't have to worry about them moving or forgetting about it and then coming back later. And would it be, that what I'm asking is, would it be easier if we could clean up that language for you?
Chair Canope, Representative Barker, it probably would make things easier in the sense that it would lower record keeping over time. But right now, the right, if you will, or the statutory ability or opportunity to keep your money in the fund for up to 5 years earning interest is part of the plan structure. It's part of the offer to members, if you will. Whether there's a contract right associated with it or not, I don't know. But the point is that it is now an opportunity that is afforded all members, and so it would require a change in the plan structure, not just a simple administrative change. It's a change in the opportunities that you afford public employees who are members of the plan.
And one more, if I may. Well, with negative returns, I would assume that's encouraging people in this that have quit to come back and get their money out.
Chair Canope, Representative Barker, there are negative returns everywhere in the marketplace right now, not just in the PERS fund.
And Chair Knope, President Barker, just as one also clarification is for those that are Tier 1 members, they would have a guarantee. Although I have to think about that. There actually may not be anyone that has less than 5 years as a Tier 1 at this point. We're probably getting beyond that point.
But they have had a guarantee up till about this point. We should be leaving that era about now for inactive members that are not vested.
I guess. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I've been keeping track here on my calculator, and we're pretty close to have used up $120,000 that was set aside in these accounts some time ago. But in all seriousness, my concern is that we probably need further information from council relative to the issues where on line 19, as Steve has indicated, it talks about all the earnings, because I would not want this act to create any additional contract right or to bestow any additional right upon those accounts or the principal thereof beyond that which has already been credited, reported, and reflected in those accounts beyond the dates that they became inactive. And I wouldn't want our discussions here today to indicate that that's what we have attempted to do, was to bestow any additional income or right to those folks who have had access to those accounts and have seen their balances, some of whom have seen their balances not grow from many years ago. So as we go back to council, I'd want to make absolutely certain that we're not bestowing any additional right to those accounts. We're already in a deficit situation. Probably it's a kindness to these folks that we haven't taken anything away because of the losses which we've incurred in the market. Thank you.
Anyone else? Thanks. Anyone else wishing to testify? This bill proving once again that there are no easy purse bills. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2343. And Judge Smallman, we're going to try to take this up again and
pass the hat.
And I have a feeling we'll be able to get this bill out of the committee on a future date, but we don't want to act in haste because it may have implications as we go forward. So I think Representative Butler's counsel is probably wise to seek legislative counsel's opinion on the issues that he referred to as it relates to earnings and contract rights. So we will don't feel the need to come back and testify again. We do have your testimony on the record. If you'd like to come back, you're certainly welcome. But I suspect you still live quite a ways away from Salem. So having said that, I'll be in contact with Representative Jensen on your bill. And so when we bring it back up again, I'll make him aware of it so he can also make you aware that action is taking place on your bill.
Thank
you for coming. We're going to reopen the public hearings on House Bills 2008 and 2020. And Jim, you're in the middle of a sentence, or you finished your sentence. And so you just pick right back up where you left off, if you can remember.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Jim Green with the Oregon School Board, representing PERS Covered Employer Coalition. I think I left off where we talked about the need for not having a money match benefit as one of the selections upon retirement. The PERS Covered Employer Coalition believes that that should not be one of the elements that's in the plan. I want to go back just for a second where I talked about the different classes. Remember I talked about general service, police and firefighter school. We also agreed that the current definition of police and firefighter that you find in statute would work within a new successor system. Everyone's played with those rules. They understand who is police and firefighter, who isn't police and firefighter. And again, we believe that there should be different classes working with the current definitions that are in statute. A couple of other points, and I'm near the end of my presentation, and these are probably some of the more controversial ones, I would assume, between our group and maybe the PERS Employee Coalition. But any successor system, we believe, should not include a disability plan in it. This is a retirement system. We believe a successor retirement system is that. Plain and simple, a retirement system, not a disability insurance plan. Local entities should design those. And in many cases, they have. They have workers' compensation insurance if the injury occurs on work. But under the current system, there is no requirement that it be on a job-related injury. And it has obviously escalated some costs. City of Huntington, if you take a look at their rate, which is in excess of 100% of payroll, which is the new rate that was just ordered yesterday by the PERS board, that is due to disabilities. They have very small number of employees. They had a couple go out on disability. And finally, one of the things that has always been talked about is the ability to opt in or opt out as an employer. Currently in the system, you have the ability to opt in if you're not in. School districts were never given the choice. We were told we were in. The state was told they were in. The community college is told they were in. Local governments have the ability right now. Cities, counties, and special districts have the ability to opt in. We would like to see in any type of a successor system the ability for employers at some point to opt out of the system should they decide to opt out. Obviously, that's going to be a discussion that they would have with their employees, a discussion that may take place at the collective bargaining table. But we believe that a successor system should allow those folks the ability to opt out if they opt into the system. Again, these are our general comments with regard to a successor system. We continue to meet to design it. We've been asked also, should it be a defined benefit or a defined contribution plan? And there is discussions going on amongst the four associations on that point, but I will tell you this, it depends on what's in the details of that plan. I could create a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan that was provided a higher benefit than the current system we have or provided a much lower benefit. It's always going to be, the devils are going to be in the details of the plan that's created. If there is going to be talk about a successor system, obviously, since we're the public employers that will generally fund that, we would like to be at the table. One final point within a successor system deals with the issue of health insurance and a Medicare supplement. Currently, that system is wholly paid by employers. There is a provision in current statute that says at the time in which those funds are available to pay the system, there will no longer be an employer contribution to that. Currently, at least for school districts, part of our rate, 0.64% of our rate, is due to this Medicare supplement. We believe it's a pure retirement system. Again, no disability or no health care benefit should be provided. Remember, we are also required to carry our retired employees on our current health systems as if they were active. That's raised our cost dramatically. That's a statute that we're taking a look at as well with regard to an issue outside of PERS. But we believe a retirement system should be that plain and simple, a pure retirement system. Disability should be taken care of by the employer at the local level. Health insurance is always going to be a subject of collective bargaining, and those discussions go on daily within our school districts that I'm aware of when we get to the table. We have many districts in contract negotiations right now. We believe any successor system should be plain and simple a retirement system. Some of the costs associated with the current one we can attribute to some of the other things that have been added to this plan over time. Again, it should be a separate system from what we currently have. It should have a separate set of statutes and be easily explainable to both employers and employees and the public and the taxpayers that may fund that system, as well as provide cost affordability for employers and taxpayers, and also provide stability for employees so they know what their benefit's going to be, they understand what their retirement plan could entail, and that we don't have ongoing things such as the current system. I think the executive director of PERS, Jim Voitko, who was up here earlier, has done a pretty good presentation. I think he did it to the financial advisors up in Portland back in November, which was what's going on at PERS. And it's a very complex system. If you read the statutes, and I've taken to the point where I have to actually carry them with me now, they're in my briefcase here with me, and I get a question from a school district, I have to look it up and get back to them, and then I may have to call PERS and get their advice on it. It's a complex system. It's been around since 1953. The previous one was before that. And we've added to it and added to it and added to it. And it's gotten to the point now where, one, it's become a very costly system for the taxpayers and employers, and it's become very complex. We have litigation ongoing now, and we will probably have continuing litigation on the issues that may be surrounding the current system. We would like to see those type of complexities eliminated in any sort of successor system. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Our comments are not in writing as of yet, but we can get those to the committee so that you have the points of the PERS Covered Employer Coalition, and we'll get that to you next week.
Thank you. As it relates to a defined benefit plan, do you see where that would provide or could provide a predictable cost, which is one of the things you indicated that you wanted to see for employers?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it could. Again, remember, it's always going to be, the devil's going to be in the details on how you create that system and the statutory provisions you put in it. A defined benefit could create that cost affordability. So could a defined contribution. Again, depending on bells, whistles, limitations, what have you, that could be put into the plan and statute.
Okay, so you're open to either one.
As of right now, we're still looking into that. We hope to have that decision made by our coalition within the next couple of weeks as to which one, because both, you know, 08 and 2020, one's a defined benefit, one's a defined contribution, and it really depends on what you put in the plan, and then you need to have an actuary take a look at that system to let you know what the costs are associated with it and whether there is predictability in the benefit that may be due an employee at the end of the system.
As it relates to disability, were you speaking, I know you represent school districts, were you speaking in terms of just the school district's part or general service, or were you speaking that you thought the system as a whole, even though you indicated that police and fire ought to be dealt with separately, but they shouldn't have disability either?
Mr. Chairman, my comments with regard to the disability state simply that this is a retirement system, not a disability system, because part of the problem with the current system that we see, at least, and I'm sure my friends on the other side of the aisle may not agree with us on this, but costs have been associated with the disability payments that have to be made, because under statute, if you're determined to have a disability by a physician that the PERS board has, that medical decision is made, you're given a benefit at that time. That benefits as if you had worked for your employer until the time of retirement. That's why costs are associated with it, like the city of Huntington is currently experiencing. And they are part of the litigation that's ongoing. But when you take a look at, I think they had three or four employees, two of them very young employees went out on a disability. That's why their rates went through the roof. And we believe that is one of the things you can do to put some cost containment on a new system. We're not saying that there shouldn't be some sort of disability payment there. We believe that ought to be taken care of by the local employer. And if it's obviously work-related, you're talking workers' compensation then.
So strictly retirement, no bells and whistles.
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Barker.
I'm not sure I understood. You were talking about paid medical after retirement. Is that in the PERS statute? I wasn't aware of that because I know some people who don't have that. And I know teachers, there's some teachers through their labor negotiations have that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, it's not part of the PERS statute. It's found in health insurance statutes, and what's required under it is that you have to offer to your retired employees the health plan that your currents have, and they are not allowed to be priced separately. So what that has done, at least in the area of school districts, has raised our costs dramatically because, as you well can imagine, retired folks generally tend to access the health care system, medications, and need hospitalization, medical treatment more than your active employees. That has driven up our costs. That was a statute, I believe, that was put in place in 1990. It was either 3 or 5.
And if I may follow, thank you. So that's on their own dime, but they just get to stay in the group.
They get to stay in the group, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker. They do get to stay in the group, but that raises that risk pool cost.
I understand that. Thank you.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Green, you haven't addressed the issue of part-time employees and benefits for part-time employees as the representative for the employers. Would you like to address that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, thank you for reminding me of that. In part of including whether you ought to be able to opt into the plan or opt out of the plan, one of the things that our four associations have talked about is we believe that the employer should be provided the option of whether they want to include in temporary part-time seasonal employees. And that's going to be determined either by some sort of collective bargaining agreement with the employees that are there, or they can have a different benefit structure for those folks who may be part-time seasonal employees.
Hold on. Now, relating to the disability, did I understand you correctly that if a person is hired and they were on the job for a month and they're 22 years old and they were disabled, their calculations for their disability payments become as if they had been there for 30 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, no, there are other qualifications that need to be met, and they're found in the statutes with regard to the disability system. I believe it's 238.320 is the section Steve's left the room, hasn't he, Jim? Yeah, it's 238-320, and for, let's see, an employee who's been a member after being examined by more than one-on-one, I think it is 7 years, who's a member, been an employee of 10 years for the employer participating in the system. So they must be in the system, at least for that employer, for 10 years.
Okay, and then if they're disabled, they get 20 years worth of benefits as if they had worked for 30 years instead of the 10 years. Is that correct?
They receive the same prior service pension the member would have received had the member worked until normal retirement age.
Okay. Well, under the current medical plans, if you have a husband and wife both working for public employers, is it correct that, say, a person wants to have eye benefits and they go and they get glasses under their own card, that they could then go back and get contact lenses or additional glass or something like this as a dependent on their spouse's card?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, that depends on the health insurance plan that they have. Are you talking about the system that's here within the PERS system currently, or are you talking about health insurance plans?
In the PERS system.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, I don't know the answer to that because it's going to depend also on whether their spouse or the other person is employed currently and has insurance coverage at their job as well, in which their spouse or other one is covered. Maybe someone else in the audience has the answer to that, but I don't.
Chair Canoe, Representative Richardson, obviously for many state employees, health insurance is covered by PEB, and we're not really expert in that. With respect to the health insurance, the Medicaid Plus or gap insurance that the PERS administers, it is a $60 subsidy toward the cost of their monthly health insurance premium. So it's $60 a month per qualified retiree. I believe we have about 45,000 retirees who do get the subsidy, number one. Number two is they have to participate in the health plans that PERS negotiates statewide. And then the subsidy applies to that monthly premium. In terms of magnitude, it accounts, and I can't remember how much in the rate, I think somebody said about 0.64%, and that sounds about right of an employer's rate. It is entirely employer paid, and currently because it's a new plan and has very little assets in its own trust fund or its own to fund that particular benefit, it accounts for about $500 million of the UAL. I hope that gives you some perspective.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, for the state and community college, it's 0.74% of their rate because the state does not have the Medicare. They've opted out of that part, so there is a prepaid part that goes to the state, which community colleges also get lumped into, which is a additional cost to community colleges, which we're trying to address in another area.
Okay, one final question.
Final follow-up.
Relating to your provision about opting out and the right for the employer to opt out, were you talking about a single opportunity at the time that a new plan is implemented or the ability to opt out at any time in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, that would be under a successor system plan, the ability to opt out at the employer's option. Obviously, for sake of ease of the system may want to know on certain dates each year. But our belief is that the employer should have the ability to opt out at any time in the system if they choose to opt in.
Okay.
That's in a successor system.
Representative Barker.
And so would you still think it would be proper to have the equal to or better than clause for people opting out that they'd still, so that the employees would know they would have a pension system? I mean, if you're...
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, that only really applies to the police and firefighter if they hold a separate plan out there for police and firefighter, the equal to or better than clause that's currently within statute is my understanding. When we talked about keeping the definition of police and firefighter, I believe we also included in that if they have their own plan out there that the term better to or equal than would also go away. That they would create a system, and assuming, and I don't represent the entities that have those folks, but that those would be open in discussions they would have with their employees.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question relative to the successor plan, and 208 and 2020 are both successor plans. Would you anticipate, and I'm coming back to the
school districts being one of the largest employers in many of the small areas that I represent in southeastern Oregon, would you anticipate that, that school districts, Jim, right up front, would just opt out of these kinds of programs, creating their own, because between the organization that you represent, representing all school boards, you could actually develop within the school systems itself, themselves probably some pretty nice retirement plans, and basically the state wouldn't necessarily, the other state and public employees wouldn't be participating in that. Have you discussed that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, that's an interesting question because I get that call almost daily from school districts out there, and you might understand their hesitancy to join another public employee retirement system with the costs associated with the one they're currently in. Some of them already do additional retirement benefit planning for their members through 403B plans, which are tax-exempt for educators. They're a little unique to the folks that I represent. A lot of them do that. There are other plans that they've instituted, some deferred compensation that's outside the PERS system that they do. Some of them have indicated that if there was the ability to not join the system, they would have their druthers to not join a state system. And primarily that's due to what they've experienced in the current system and the costs that have driven those systems up. Now, if it were a system that had the controls in it that we've talked about, I believe that you would see more school districts opt into it, and the reason for that is the portability between school districts. While we have one of the higher rates for school employees, that's because once you become a school employee or a teacher administrator, you tend not to leave as school employment. So you build up time, and you also grow up on the salary schedule there as you get more experience. And that is one of the nice things in our current system is you leave work in Salem-Keizer and you go to work in Dallas, you know what your retirement system is. It helps with recruitment. That is one of the reasons why we talked about portability needs to be necessary in the plan.
And just by way of comment, Mr. Chair, I would guess the schools and community colleges would feel somewhat put upon because they've never had an opportunity to opt into a program. It's always been mandated for those folks. Unlike other local governments may have had an opportunity.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Green, as a matter of economy, what would be your position on the exact opposite of what we're discussing? Supposing that the state were to collectively bargain for all the school districts, would that not save money and save a lot of time to get the benefit of such a huge group?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, if you're talking about statewide collective bargaining for school employees across the state, my association has traditionally and still to this day opposes that idea. The reason is you want to be sure that those folks that have the closest connection to the parents and those folks in that school district have the say over the largest part of their budget. If you were to take away 80% of the control of the budget, which is about the cost associated with our personnel in school districts, that school district board really doesn't have what it deems to be any power. It'll just sit there pretty much as a policy-making body. And I think if you take a look at our neighbors to the north, where they have teachers' mass in March on their capital, that may not be the best thing you want to do every other year when you're in session. But we still believe, and our membership does, while there are members of our association that would say, take it off our hands, get us out of the business of doing collective bargaining, our membership has discussed that issue, and to even this session, we still support local collective bargaining because we believe that locally elected school board has the closest connections to its patrons and also understands the economy within that community, perhaps better than the 90 of you may sitting here in Salem. I wouldn't necessarily support the idea of you folks setting the salary, and then you get into the cost differences between Baker City and what Portland costs and what Beaverton costs and housing. I mean, it's all the things you get into in the formula about the rust factor on the coast and the snow factor in eastern Oregon and the costs associated with that. That's where you may run into some trouble.
Follow up. As a practical matter, I hear what you're saying, but the school districts presently have responsibility for collective bargaining but do not have the authority to generate the revenue. And so having been on a school board budget committee and having seen it in action, quite often the school boards end up holding their budgetary proceedings coming up with a budget, but having no concept whether or not they're going to be able to fund that budget, because they don't know until a month or two later what the revenues are going to be that come from Salem.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, while this discussion is outside the scope of a successor session system, I agree with you. Our local budget committee budget law was a great idea when we were able to say to our taxpayers, okay, this is the amount we're getting from the state. We have to go out and get property taxes to pay for it. But now our budget committees are meeting in the next couple of months, and I don't believe you are going to have the appropriation ready for the next school year in the next couple of months. If you are, we'll gladly take a look at it and let our budget committees know what's out there. But, and if you have a 10% change in your budget, you've got to reconstitute. Over this last couple of years and the five very special sessions we just went through, they reconstitute their budget committees quite often.
Thank you. Looks like on the coalition side, Leslie Frame and Pat West, is that right?
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Leslie Frame, and I'm the executive director of SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. My union represents 35,000 employees in the public and nonprofit sectors, and approximately 23,000 of our members are members of the PERS system. I want to thank the chair and the members of this committee for giving me the opportunity to testify today on behalf of the PERS Coalition, a group of unions that, among us, represent the majority of employees who are members of PERS. The PERS Coalition recognizes that some changes in the PERS system are both inevitable and necessary in order to make the system sustainable in the long term. We support responsible PERS reform, which we define as reform that protects the core integrity of our members' benefits and reform that does not violate the legal and moral promises made to public employees when they agreed to perform certain services for their employers in exchange for a specified compensation package. One change that we are prepared to support as part of a responsible PERS reform package is the creation of a successor system for newly hired employees if the new system is designed in accordance with certain key principles. In the past, we have opposed the creation of a new system for new hires, just as we opposed the creation of Tier 2 8 years ago. Our historical opposition to new plans for new hires has been based on the divisiveness and the intrinsic inequity of having two groups of employees working side by side, compensated under two unequal plans. This is different than seniority-based pay, in which newer employees know that over time they will ultimately catch up to the pay rates of more senior employees. However, because we recognize the seriousness of the economic problems facing the state and the PERS system, we have overcome our principled opposition to multi-tier compensation systems in this case. We are prepared to support the creation of a successor retirement plan for newly hired employees, provided that the plan meets certain criteria. We do this as part of our effort to help bring long-term stability to the PERS system. We think that it's possible to create a new system for new hires that is simpler, more stable, and less costly than either tier of the current system, while still providing quality retirement benefits for public employees. And in the remainder of my testimony, I will lay out the components that a successor plan would need to have in order to gain our support. Our first principle is that the successor plan must be a defined benefit plan. The relative merits of defined benefit and defined contribution plans have been debated at great length many times in the past. I don't expect to be able to add any great pearls of wisdom to that debate here today. Let me just simply say briefly that the prevalence of defined contribution plans in the private sector should not motivate policymakers to move in that direction. Oregon will make a serious mistake if we try to model our system on the excesses of some parts of the private sector, in which many retirees live well below the poverty line after the stock market erodes their paltry 401k accounts. Rather, Oregon should strive to be a responsible employer, providing high-quality but affordable retirement benefits through a straightforward defined benefit plan. Criterion number two concerns the replacement ratio in the new plan. As you know, defined benefit pensions are based on a formula that reflects an employee's average final salary, his or her years of service, and a multiplier. The formula is designed to result in a retirement benefit that replaces a certain percentage of an employee's pre-retirement income. The current full formula benefit in PERS uses a multiplier of 1.67% for general service employees and 2.0% for police and fire, resulting in a retirement benefit of 50% of pre-tax salary for employees who retire after a full career. For a new plan for new hires, this replacement ratio is not sufficient. We believe that the multiplier should be no less than 2% for general service employees and 2.4% for police and fire, which would result in retirement benefits of 60% of pre-tax pre-retirement income after a full career. The 2.4% multiplier takes into account the fact that retirees become eligible for Social Security benefits later than they used to. It also factors in the monumental increase in medical costs that retirees now face, especially before they become eligible for Medicare, but after Medicare kicks in as well. It's worth noting that a 2%, 2.4% multiplier would put Oregon in the mainstream of public sector pension plans. The current full formula, with its 1.67%, 2% multiplier, is significantly below the standard set by state and teachers' pension plans in other states. With PERS, Oregon has a retirement plan that is more generous than the average public sector pension plan. In designing a successor plan, let's not go to the opposite extreme and use a formula that would place us nearer to the bottom. A defined benefit successor plan with a 2%, 2.4% multiplier would result in significant savings over the current system. Not only would it cost less than Tier 1, it would also cost less than Tier 2. PERS Fund actuary Mark Johnson has worked hard to quantify these cost reductions, and his analysis is instructive. Johnson's work shows that the normal cost for Tier 2 employees is 15.81% of payroll. That's under 10% after the pickup. In contrast, the normal cost of a defined benefit, of a basic defined benefit pension with a 2.4% multiplier would be 14.26%, or 8% after the pickup. This assumes that the new plan contains a 2% annual COLA for retirees, but that unused sick time is not factored into retirement benefits in a successor plan. If it seems counterintuitive that a new plan with a higher multiplier should cost less, would cost less than the current plan, please remember that the successor plan eliminates money match, and money match is one of the principal cost drivers of the current system in both Tier 1 and also Tier 2. Our third criterion for a successor plan is that participation in this plan can be required only for newly hired employees. For reasons that you've heard in previous testimony, we oppose efforts to force current employees into a new plan. Doing so would breach the promises made to these employees, and it would deprive them of key valued elements of the PERS plan. However, we would support the creation of voluntary incentives to encourage PERS members to opt voluntarily into a successor plan. Especially for less senior employees, creating such incentives would be easier than one might initially anticipate. For any employee who thinks that he or she is likely to retire under PERS on a full formula benefit rather than a money match benefit, opting into the new plan that we've outlined would make sense because the replacement ratio in the new plan would be higher than the replacement ratio in the full formula benefit provided in PERS. For employees who expect to retire on money match, creating incentives to switch into a new plan would be harder, but it would still be possible. Imagine, for example, if we allowed employees who shifted from PERS to the new plan to cash out part of their PERS account in tax-free dollars that could be used to purchase post-retirement health care benefits. Our members' anxiety level about escalating medical costs is extremely high. Such an option would be a powerful incentive. This is just an example of the kind of incentive that would entice employees to opt voluntarily into the successor plan, with resulting savings to the state in the form of reduced retirement costs. Let me close by listing very briefly some of the other elements that we believe a successor system should have. It should be a new system, not a Tier 3, so that we can be freed up from the unnecessary complexity and the conflicting requirements of the current system. No one benefits from the amount of litigation that is inevitable under the morass of rules that currently govern PERS. It should be implemented quickly, so that the state can fill the large number of vacancies that will likely result from the implementation of new mortality tables with less costly new plan employees rather than Tier 2 PERS employees. Finally, like the current PERS system, the successor plan should include all PERS employers. We don't want to fix PERS for some employees, only to have groups of local government or school employees forced out of the system completely by employers who, quote, opt out of PERS. I'd like to thank you again for listening to our perspective on what a successor plan would look like. For our unions, supporting the creation of a successor plan for new hires is very difficult because it means accepting that our future members will get retirement benefits that, on average, are smaller than what our members are currently entitled to. That is not something that we ever do lightly. However, we take our commitment to responsible PERS reform very seriously. Our members, who are currently under the gun on all sides, on wages, on health care, on retirement, and on jobs, are committed to being part of the solution to the economic crisis currently facing Oregon. To further that goal, we will support the establishment of a successor retirement plan for new hires, provided that it meets the criteria that I've outlined. Thank you for your time, and we'd love the opportunity to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Pat. Did you have anything to say? Or?
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Please excuse my voice. I woke up this morning and didn't have one. It came back a little bit, so I'll keep this short. Again, my name is Pat West. I'm president of the Oregon State Firefighters and here representing the PERS Coalition also, and primarily going to be touching base on some of the issues dealing with PNF. I don't know how many of you understand the difference here, but basically the 2%, 2.4 compilation is the same percentage as it was at 1.672%. And what that's based on is that PNF is based on a 25-year career and general service is based on a 30-year career. So, and that's how those numbers came to be. I just wanted you to know that that's how we got to those numbers. I would also like to talk about the disability provisions of the PERS system. It's very important to our members that we continue to have disability through the PERS system. Police officers and firefighters have a dangerous job, and there's many injuries that happen to people throughout their career, and it's very important for them to have the disability provisions under PERS. And one of the things that I would like to point out is that the original system provided a 50% retirement at the end of their career. And that 50% was based upon the fact that at that time Oregon PERS retirement was non-taxed. So that was taken into account when they determined that the 50% would be adequate to provide the benefits that people need to live on in retirement. As you well know, after House Bill 3349, PERS benefits are taxed. That's part of the reason that we have suggested that we go to a higher multiplier. And the other one is that we made it simpler by taking sick leave out of the formula. That's one of the more contentious things that we've heard about through PERS was the fact that people that had sick leave on the books when they retired, it would get added into their retirement. So our proposal has taken the sick leave off and out of the formula. But again, we've increased the multiplier. And I don't know, and listening to the testimony earlier, there was discussions about insurance and everything, and I don't know if everybody understood exactly that PERS does not provide paid insurance for people prior to Medicare. There's no PERS provided insurance paid by PERS. They have a plan available that the people can buy insurance through the PERS based on whatever the rates are for the PERS system. The only provided insurance is the 60% Medicare supplement for those people that are 65 or older.
$60?
Pardon?
$60?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's a $60 a month supplement is what it is.
I heard you say 60%, and that's why.
Oh, I'm sorry. If I did, I spoke.
Yeah. Well, that's what I heard.
Incorrectly.
I heard correctly.
Well, with that, I think I'll close my testimony. I think Leslie covered the major issues of what we feel the plan should be very well. Any questions? I'll be happy to answer them.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson.
Leslie, when you were describing the cost of the replacement ratios that you're advocating for, it sounded as though you're including an employee contribution that presumably would be picked up in those numbers. Is that right? Because I heard a reference to 14 or 15% and including the pickup.
Right.
Understanding that correctly?
That's correct. Those numbers included the pickup.
Right. Mr. Chair, if I could?
Yeah.
If we were to look at a system for new hires that was required no employee contribution, it was entirely employer paid, so that the employees could then use that 6% for other benefits, perhaps for a defined contribution savings kind of vehicle, like a 403B contribution or other kinds of savings, would that then, since the employer paid portion would be a smaller amount, would be the total amount of the system, would be a smaller benefit, would that change your perspective on what the replacement ratio would be from the defined benefit portion? That is, if we were to look at a system that was did not require employee contributions, so the employee could save those dollars through a defined contribution mechanism and they were entirely employer paid, would a replacement ratio that was below the 2.4% then be something that would seem reasonable?
See, I think we would rather not go in that direction. I think what you're describing is having a smaller defined benefit pension, but then having a defined contribution option on top of that, common sense would say that if you have two pensions, the first one doesn't need to be as big as the second one. But we are very committed to the core defined benefit approach, and we would rather not have that option, but instead say that 6% was always, regardless of who pays it, and in some bargaining units it's paid by the employer, and in some bargaining unit it's paid by the employee, but regardless of who pays that, we want that money to contribute to the core defined benefit pension so that that benefit can be large enough to, combine with Social Security, provide a replacement ratio that's high enough to support people. So theoretically, you're correct, but our preference is to go is to put all of the available dollars into the base pension plan.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Richardson.
Let's think. At the beginning, you said that you support responsible PERS reform, and then as you were discussing the apps, you said we must have a defined benefit plan, and then explain because the employee should not have to be responsible in case there's problems with the stock market. And yet, part of the problem that we're facing with the PERS situation that we're in now is that it has been any downside or problems with stock market have been solely borne by the employer. And so, do you think that it's fully responsible for us to have a new plan that essentially sets the employer up to carry all responsibility and the employee have no responsibility when markets are volatile?
Let me respond to that in two ways. The question that you're raising, Representative Richardson, is the question of should risk be on the shoulders of the employer as it is in a defined benefit plan or on the shoulders of the employees as it is in a defined contribution plan?
Isn't it both on both in defined contribution, not merely the employee, because the employer is the one that's actually paying the money?
Well, in a straight defined contribution plan, the employer puts a certain amount of money in the account, and the employee may also put money in that account, but it rises or falls as the stock market rises or falls, and then the employee gets what they get. There is no risk to the employer, because if the stock market tanks, oh well, the employee just has a smaller benefit. So in a straight defined contribution plan, there's no risk to the employer, as I understand it.
Okay. May I follow up?
Follow up.
But when Representative McPherson discussed the possibility of a combination plan, your opposition also was that that also was not acceptable?
That's correct. And our belief is that shared risk makes sense in a context when you're operating from a level playing field, and that we don't think, as between the state of Oregon and the individual employee, that there is a level playing field in terms of the respective parties' ability to tolerate risk. For the state of Oregon, or for the PERS, the employment system, whatever name it goes by, to tolerate risk means that it may, for a period of time, have an unfettered liability, and then when the stock market recovers, that liability will be erased and financial health will be restored. That's very different from the situation of an employee, particularly a low-paid employee. If the stock market, if the bottom falls out in the stock market for that employee, the impact of shouldering the risk is often choosing between paying for your prescription drugs and paying for your food. And so we think that it is more appropriate that the risk be on the shoulders of the employers rather than the employees. Having said that, we also think that the level of risk needs to be reduced. And one way of reducing the level of risk is to create a system which has a lower base cost, which the successor plan that we've outlined would do. And by reducing the costs, you reduce the risk to the employer. I also think that there's a contrast between, I mean, states throughout the union have unfunded liabilities right now, and that's because of the stock market. And states that have a base defined benefit plan are running unfunded liabilities, and in most cases, the actuaries in those states say, this is bad news, but when the stock market recovers, we will be able to fill the unfunded liability, and eventually, I mean, opinions differ as to how long it's going to take, but eventually that will happen. So I think that risk in what is a stable defined benefit plan can be tolerated by a public employee retirement system, because over time, as the stock market recovers, the liability that was created would be filled. What's happening here in Oregon is different, and it's a problem that is unique to Oregon because of the driving force of the money match system and the structure. So I think we need to address some of those structural issues for creating a successor plan that doesn't have some of those structural concerns. But still, we believe that the appropriate entity to carry the risk when it comes to a retirement plan is the employer and not the employees.
Shut up. Representative Barker?
Maybe you could answer this for me. In 2001, I went to a conference, the National Conference of Public Employee Retirement Systems. And at that conference, they said that public employee systems, 96% are defined benefit and only 4% or defined contribution. Has that changed, or do you think that's the same?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, it has pretty much stayed. There's been a few of the local jurisdictions that went to a defined contribution plan, and most of them have actually started the process of converting back to a defined benefit.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I just had one more comment that I forgot to mention. This is something that I could actually agree with the employers on, and that was that I agree that we spent 20 years honing the definition of P&F, and I really would not like to spend another 20 going through it. For those of you who have been in the building, it took a long time to get the definitions of police officer and firefighter down to where we know who's in, we know who's out, and I would hope that we wouldn't have to go through that again.
Thank you. Leslie, I have a question that I don't want you to take as combative, because I really do appreciate the fact that you guys have come forward today and have kind of given us your position, which I hope isn't a take it or leave it offer, because I know you're a tough negotiator. But why shouldn't employees have a choice between a defined contribution and a defined benefit system? And the reason I ask the question is it seems to me that a defined benefit system doesn't necessarily work well for all employees. And the example I've used in the past is that somebody who retires early from, maybe it's a firefighter who retires early or retires on time, you know, after 25 years and he's 50 years old or maybe even a little younger, and decides that he wants to make teaching a career. And but he only wants to spend 5 or 10 years doing it. And so
It doesn't seem to me that it would make sense for him to, for him or her, I should say, to have a defined, you know, benefit. Maybe it would be more appetizing to have a defined contribution. And the other example I've used is maybe somebody who comes to work, like with the governor's administration, and stays 4 years or 8 years or whatever, and then goes back to the private sector. And maybe a defined benefit plan doesn't work for them. And I would suggest maybe that a majority of employees that would want to stay in public employment over their career lifetime would probably prefer a defined benefit, but maybe there are folks, and there clearly are, who come to work at government one time or another, but don't stay and go back to the private sector, or have come from the private sector. Why shouldn't they have a choice between two systems?
That's a good question. I don't consider it combative at all. A couple reasons. The current PERS system really has an option which accommodates the short-term employee, because when they leave, there is a cash-out option. And that's something that we've talked about in some of the discussions around this plan, that you don't need necessarily to have a defined contribution component in order to have a cash-out option for the short-term employee who leaves. So I think that there are ways of accommodating the person who's in and out of the system because they work in the governor's administration or whatever the circumstances, without creating a whole parallel system. I also worry a lot, particularly for lower-wage workers, about younger employees who aren't thinking about their retirement, who do what makes sense in the short run, a defined contribution plan, particularly if it's a defined contribution plan where they can structure their contribution amount, and so they say, well, you know, I'd rather have it in my paycheck today. And I think that an awful lot of people wind up in long-term trouble and that end up without the kind of retirement security which we think needs to be sort of the underpinning of any any retirement plan. So I think it is a good question that raises some important philosophical issues about choice. But the bottom line is, I think that we can accommodate some of those concerns through a withdrawal option. Right now, the withdrawal is based on your individual account. It would not make sense in going to a defined benefit type plan to have individual accounts. That would be unnecessary administrative work. But it would certainly be possible to structure a withdrawal option for people who leave the system quickly to say, you know, they have a regular pension somewhere else, like in the example that you gave. And for them, I think that there can be variation without creating a whole defined contribution infrastructure.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate folks' participation today. We'll obviously have more hearings, multiple hearings, where we will take public testimony. Is there anybody who feels a need to put something on the record today? Okay, if not, we will close the public hearings on invited testimony for 2008 and 2020, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2004 for the purposes of taking response or entering into the record response from Bill Geary as it relates to the Internal Revenue Code. So I believe that was distributed earlier and will be entered into the record. Close the work session on House Bill 2004. If there's nothing else for the good of the committee, will be adjourned, and we will meet again on Tuesday and hopefully have amendments for which to talk about. Thank you.